All right, now, these last few weeks we've been considering together the special call that God has given to the prophet Ezekiel. God came to Ezekiel in chapter 1 with that glorious vision of himself, immediately after which he called him into the prophetic office, and then gave him specific instructions in chapter 3 and repeated in almost verbatim form with a greater detailed introduction in chapter 33 of the specific responsibility and commission that he had for the prophet, that he was going to be a watchman. And we've spent some little time now looking at these personal commands, instructions that God had given to the prophet. Now, today, at least at the beginning, I want to take a little briefer look at some of the specific acts that God instructed Ezekiel to perform as we try to bring to a close at least this part of our study on the prophet himself and the specific instructions and responsibilities that God gave the prophet. When we first began discussing this together, I suggested that the overall message of Ezekiel was twofold. On the one hand, he had a message of destruction, judgment that was going to come upon the people because of their sin, and that was balanced with a great message of hope or restoration, that God would come back in deliverance of the people. We took some time to establish the historical context of Ezekiel, remembering then that he is right in the middle of God's dealings in chastisement upon the Jewish people, and particularly the capital of Jerusalem. Remembering the first stage of captivity took place in 605. That's when Daniel and his friends were taken into Babylon by Nebuchadnezzar. The final destruction of the city was going to take place in 586, 587, under still the command of Nebuchadnezzar. The city would be completely destroyed. Now, Ezekiel falls in the middle of those two dates. He was taken captive into Babylon in 597. And here, he along with the king of Israel that was taken into exile, Jeconiah, Kaniah, Jehoiachin, called three different ways by three different names in the Old Testament. He was there, and 10,000 of the noblemen of the nation were now held captive in Babylon. And consequently, to see Ezekiel where he is in that historic context, I think explains nicely why his message is twofold. There was still a message of destruction and of judgment that had to come. God was not yet finished with these people. Remembering that there were a great many of those that were hearing Ezekiel's message that thought that this was enough, that God had dealt with them severely enough. But Ezekiel warns them, no, the sin is of such a degree that the judgment is not yet complete. There is a worse devastation to come. And so he preaches that that judgment is indeed going to come finally and completely upon Jerusalem. But yet there's also a message of hope. And unlike Jeremiah, who was his contemporary back in the land of Israel, whose message was primarily a message of judgment with really very little lights of hope and rays of hope that were given forth by Jeremiah, although there was some. Ezekiel had a great message of hope that God was going to come back in blessing upon this land. There was going to be a great restoration. Now that twofold message of judgment followed by restoration and blessing encompassed really the entire scope of what Ezekiel was to do before these people. Now, God instructed Ezekiel to portray this message in various ways. We have many visions that Ezekiel received, and he then would declare the content of those visions to the people. We're going to study some of those in great detail. Chapter 8 is going to be one of those significant visions. Chapter 8 and 9 really going together there. A vision that God reveals to him concerning the terrible sin of the people and the judgment that's going to come, but yet the blessing for those that receive the mark of the man with the inkhorn. A very fascinating chapter there, number 9. But that's a vision. There were times when God instructed Ezekiel to use illustrations, to tell parables or allegories to the people to illustrate some particular truth. And we're going to look at some of those in detail as well. Chapter 16, one of the great allegories, parables, illustrations that Ezekiel used as he views the nation as that little infant that was found bloodied and desolate and destitute alongside the road. And God now, as the Lord comes and takes this child and nurtures it and causes it to grow and gives it great wealth and blessing. And then that child rebels against that one that was the Savior. And that is to be a picture of God's dealing with the nation of Israel. In chapter 23, we're going to see another parable or allegory that the Lord gives of two sisters. One sister representing Samaria, the other representing Israel, of Judah. And their great wickedness and sin and the judgment that comes because of that. That's just different ways that God used Ezekiel to proclaim this message before the people. Now, one of the other methods, and that's what I want to center on for a few moments today, that God used to convey His message through Ezekiel was through a series of symbolic acts, of object lessons, if you will, that Ezekiel was to perform in the presence of these people that communicated something about the message. Now, these object lessons, these symbolic acts, are just as significant, therefore, they are just as authoritative, therefore, as the spoken word. It was God instructing Ezekiel to do these things. And the significance of these object lessons, of these symbolic acts, were designed to communicate that divine truth and that divine message to the people. So we are not to take these symbolic acts lightly. I dare say as we read through some of them, they appear to be very strange. And God had Ezekiel doing some very unusual things that we would regard as being certainly at the least out of the ordinary. But they were designed by God and defined by God to convey a very special message to the people. And they were to illustrate the truths that Ezekiel then by the spoken word would declare. But I think if we take a look at some of these object lessons, and again I'm not going to expound them in great detail for you as we've been looking at some of these preceding chapters, but if we can just look at them quickly together, I think it'll give us an overview of the entire scope of Ezekiel's message. Now, the first one occurs in chapter 4, Ezekiel chapter 4, and really there are going to be three different object lessons or symbolic acts that Ezekiel performs at the command of God in this chapter. Notice the first three verses. Thou also, son of man, take thee a tile and lay it before thee, and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem. And lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast a mount against it. Set the camp also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. Moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between thee and the city, and set thy face against it, and it shall be besieged, and thou shalt lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. All right, so the first thing that Ezekiel was to do was to build a model of the city. He was to take these little constructing materials and in the presence of the people make a model of Jerusalem. Just as your kids, or you may remember your having, you women, doll houses, yes, and we others had our little Indian forts and what, Indian teepees and military cavalry forts, yes, and we'd have those and we would play war. Well, that's about what Ezekiel was to do here. He was to construct a little model of the city of Jerusalem, and he was to lay the siege works against it, and to go through the motions there in this symbolic form of what was actually going to happen by God's command to the city. Now, this had been said in very direct terms before. But this was an object lesson, I say, that he used to put before the people so even the simplest minded could understand that God's judgment was going to fall upon the city. So that's the first object lesson. The message there is easy enough. This was going to be a sign to the house of Israel. Then in verses 4 to 8, we have the second object lesson. Lie thou also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year. Therefore thou shalt set thy face toward the siege of Jerusalem, and thine arm shall be uncovered, and thou shalt prophesy against it. All right? A strange command here. In front of this city that he had constructed, this model city, Ezekiel was to lie down on his side. Lie down on his left side for 390 days. And that period of time that he was lying upon his left side, a time of discomfort, picturing there of the captivity, and that was the northern captivity. A day for a year, and so long would be Israel, the northern kingdom's captivity. Now go back in history again. You remember that after the time of Solomon, Rehoboam comes on the scene and he takes the bad advice, and his actions against the people are foolish indeed, but in accordance to God's plan and purpose. Jeroboam becomes the first king of the northern tribes. And now Israel is divided between the north and the south. And that goes on for years and years. And God sends prophets to the north and He sends prophets to the south. And God proclaims that judgment is going to come upon this one and then this one. And in 722, God used the Assyrians to bring judgment upon the northern capital of Samaria. And Israel, the northern tribes, are scattered and they're taken captive. And other peoples are brought into the land of Israel. So Israel, the northern peoples, fell first to the hand of God's judgment. And so the prophet here is to lie down on his left side to represent the period of time under which, during which, through which, the northern peoples are going to be under the judgment, under the captivity of God. And when that's finished, turn over on your right side and stay there for 40 days. And this is going to represent the time of the southern captivity. Obviously, Judah is not represented here as suffering as long as the northern peoples, but still a time of great discomfort as the judgment is going to come. Now, this was a strange thing indeed, to lie down on your side for 390 days, then turn over and do it for 40 days. It's a long time. Now, I don't think that we would interpret this to mean that that's all he did for those 390 days followed by 40 days. He would be sore indeed. I don't think that he was doing this. Maybe you do, but I don't. This is my interpretation. The text doesn't say. I don't think he was doing this for 24 hours a day for 390 days. But I think for 390 days he went to this model and he lay down, I hate that word. He lay down on his left side for 390 days for some period of time, and that became part of his message during that day. And after 390 days he did the same thing for 40 days. Yes. I would say that when he was lying down for that period of time, he was not to move. See, that's how I would interpret, but you know, who am I? I think he was to lie there, and however long he was there, that he was not to move. But I don't know. You know, if you want to see him there for that entire period of time, you know, that's fine. The text, I think, is not clear. Okay. Well, I think it was. I think it was in a sense part of, you know, it was going on, but yet there was more judgment to come. I think this was very early in Ezekiel's ministry, when this was happening. And there is a sense in which we can view this captivity of Judah already taking place. But there was even greater devastation to come, and we tack on then to that the 70 years that Jeremiah very definitely predicts. There was obviously more to come after this time. I was hoping no one would ask me that. Is what I was hoping. And then you had to ask me that question, didn't you? I knew it was going to come. Because it is a problem there. From the standpoint that Jeremiah specifically says. Possibly. Possibly. I will confess there I don't know. But that would make sense. We don't know exactly how long Ezekiel lived through this. We know that he did. He was obviously still ministering when Jerusalem fell. So by that time, he had already been in Jerusalem 11, 12 years or so. It's possible. It's possible. But, whatever is taking place here is strange. You know, I tell you, some mornings I think I could get into this. I wish the Lord would say, "Now, Mike, just stay there. Don't." You know, I've got a message for your boys, so you just stay in bed today. And I could get into that sometimes, I think. But it certainly had a message, one way or another, to the people. Then in verses 9-17, his diet is defined there. I'll not read through all of the details concerning the diet that he's supposed to be consuming. But the point of it is that there's going to be, during the siege of Jerusalem, a scarcity of food, the contamination of food. It's a picture there of the great famine and devastation that will take place. And you only have to read of Jeremiah's account of the siege that was laid against Jerusalem to see that this indeed was practiced, and food was indeed scarce, even cannibalism taking place among the inhabitants of the city during that very terrible time when the Babylonians had surrounded the city, making it impossible for them to go in, go out. And the food supplies became scarce. So a picture here, by what he ate, of the devastation that was going to come upon Jerusalem. Then in chapter 5, the first four verses, the Lord instructs the prophet to cut his hair. Take a knife, a barber's razor, cause it to pass upon thine head, upon thy beard. Then take thee balances to weigh and divide the hair. Thou shalt burn with fire a third part in the midst of the city. When the days of siege are fulfilled, and thou shalt take a third part and smite it about with a knife, and the third part thou shalt scatter in the wind, and I will draw out a sword after them. Thou shalt also take thereof a few in number and bind them in thy skirts, then take of them again and cast them into the midst of the fire and burn them in the fire, and therefore shall a fire come forth into all the house of Israel. So he shaves and he disposes of his hair, indicating, I think, the dishonor that's going to come upon the nation, as well as the manner in which they are going to be destroyed. There's going to be a plague, a battle, exile. All of those things are pictured here in what Ezekiel is told to do with this hair that he cuts. The dishonor, obviously, as the hair would be cut in this manner, and then the disposal being a picture of the various means by which the captivity was going to continue and take place. The next object lesson comes in chapter 12, verses 3-7. Ezekiel is instructed to pack his bags and leave home. And this becomes a picture of, read the context completely here, it seems to be a picture of the exile and the attempted escape of Zedekiah king of Judah that Nebuchadnezzar had set upon the throne as the puppet king. You compare this with 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 4 and 5, and I think you'll have the historical explanation of what this here is picturing. But you remember, and I think we've talked about this before when we set up the historical context, Jeconiah, Jehoiakim, Coniah, was taken captive to Babylon there in 597 along with Ezekiel. That left Israel, Judah, without a king, and so his brother, Mattaniah, whose name then was changed to Zedekiah, Nebuchadnezzar placed upon the throne of Judah. And now he ruled there. He ruled as a puppet king of Nebuchadnezzar, never really accepted by the people as the legitimate king. They were still looking to Coniah back in Babylon as their legitimate king, so he never went down well at home. And because of that, he tried to gain the favor of the people, so he eventually rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, listening to the ploys and the plans of the people back home to raise up a defense and an attack, a defense against the armies of Nebuchadnezzar, and that's what led eventually to the final siege against Jerusalem. But you read 2 Kings chapter 25, verses 4 and 5, and you find that Zedekiah attempted escape, and it did not work. And so Ezekiel here is, I think, picturing that particular episode and the judgment then that comes upon that king. Later in this chapter, verses 17 to 20, he is found to be eating again. His rations are to be eaten with anxiety. Moreover, verse 17, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, eat thy bread with quaking, and drink thy water with trembling, and with carefulness," or with anxiety, "and say unto the people of the land, Thus saith the Lord God of the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the land of Israel, they shall eat their bread with carefulness, and drink their water with astonishment, and her land may be desolate from all that is therein, because of the violence of all them that dwell therein." So eat in a nervous manner. Eat as though the food is scarce, as though there is a fearful thing round about. And that is to be a picture of how those inhabitants of Jerusalem are going to be eating when the final conquest comes. So a picture there of the horror of the conquest and exile. The next one occurs in chapter 21. In chapter 21, verses 19 to 21. Here he is to cry and smite his thighs. He's to cry aloud, to smite his thighs, and this becomes a picture of the alarm and the grief that accompanies the judgment of God upon the city. And he hath, 21, 11 and 12. No, that's the next one. I went 11 and 12, I'm sorry. Verse 21, or chapter 21, verses 11 and 12. Verse 12 there specifically, yes. "Cry and howl, son of man, for it shall come upon my people. It shall be upon all the princes of Israel. Terrors by reason of the sword shall be upon my people. Smite therefore upon thy thigh." So this crying out loud and smiting his thighs was to be a demonstration of the grief and the alarm that would come when the judgment finally approached the city. All right, the next one is verse 19, and this is a most fascinating one to me for various reasons. This particular symbolic act leads to a great messianic passage that I'll comment here on briefly when we come to it. Notice in verse 19, pick it up at verse 18. This is a model road. This is a model road that Ezekiel is instructed to build. "The word of the Lord came unto me again, saying, Also thou son of man, appoint thee two ways, that the sword of the king of Babylon may come. Both twain shall come forth out of one land. And choose thou a place, choose it at the head of the way to the city. Appoint a way that the sword may come to Rabbath of the Ammonites, and to Judah in Jerusalem the defense. For the king of Babylon stood at the parting of the way, at the head of the two ways, to use divination. He made his arrows bright, he consulted with images, He looked in the liver, and his right hand was the divination for Jerusalem to appoint captains, to open the mouth in slaughter, to lift up the voice with shouting, to appoint battering rams against the gates, to cast a mount, to build a fort, and so forth and so forth. All right, now the picture here is, make a road. Make a road. It leads from one place, and the place from which it leads is Babylon. And you make this road, and it's going to have a fork. A fork in this road, one going to Rabbath of the Ammonites, and the other road leading to Judah and Jerusalem. And the point of this is to demonstrate that God is sovereignly bringing Nebuchadnezzar against Jerusalem. Now, the picture was that as the king, and Nebuchadnezzar being a pagan king, was going to come to these forks of the road, which way do I go? Which way do I go? Well, when decisions were to be made, they very often would use divination. And one of the means of ancient divination of these ancient Babylonians, and it's interesting, we have documentation of this procedure in various literatures from the ancient Near East, was that they would examine the liver. So that text there is to be taken very literally. He looked into the liver. Now, I really don't know what they were looking for. We flip coins. Maybe they flip the liver and see which way the liver is going to fall there in the dirt. But something in that liver would be the determination as to whether we go this way or whether we go that way. And Nebuchadnezzar came and said, well, we're going to get both of these places eventually, I suppose. Which one do we get first? Where do we go? And it was God's purpose to demonstrate that he was controlling Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, and while Nebuchadnezzar may have used his ordinary means of making decisions, God was controlling the direction that he took. We are told in the book of Proverbs, yes, the casting of lots, yes, is in the hands of God. The whole disposing of the matter is in God's hand. The casting of lots, those things that from a human perspective seem to be completely by chance, unpredictable, but the Scripture tells us that even the casting of lots, those things that are seemingly unpredictable by chance as far as man is concerned, is under the control and under the hand and direction of God. God controls even the casting of lots. Well, we can put that in the context here. God controls whatever it is that those pagans saw in the liver to make them make up their mind as to which way to go. Nebuchadnezzar was the servant of God. And the whole idea that we get from reading this particular period of Israel's history, and not just here, but particularly here, is to see that God was the sovereign controller of all of these events. Nothing was happening apart from divine intent, apart from the exercise of divine purpose. As I say, had we lived in the days of Nebuchadnezzar and the growing power of the Babylonian armies, and we would see that from a human perspective, we would interpret that, we would have our political analysis, and we would have our all of these newsmen that would be giving us what was happening, and we would view it just as though we read and hear the reports today of Reagan getting with Gorbachev and all of these political intrigues going on. It's just the normal occurrences and state of affairs. That was what it appeared to be from man. But God was controlling it all. God was controlling it. Nebuchadnezzar did not make one decision apart from the will of God. Now, he got it from a liver, maybe, but it was God controlling that liver. You don't have to be a believer in God to be controlled by God. You don't have to recognize the sovereignty of God to be so controlled by that sovereignty of God. And Nebuchadnezzar, a pagan king, was simply the accomplisher, just the pawn in the hand of God. But oh, he was great, wasn't he? He was the head of gold that Daniel saw. He was the head of gold, a mighty empire, a mighty kingdom. And I don't diminish the power of his kingdom in any way. It was a mighty kingdom, but it was nothing to God, and God was just controlling that head of gold and telling that head of gold, here, go this way. This is the way you go. And so Nebuchadnezzar's armies moved to Jerusalem, and they laid siege to Jerusalem. And so this object lesson that Ezekiel gives here of the model road was designed to teach that Nebuchadnezzar's siege of Jerusalem was not by accident, but it was according to divine providence. It was according to divine purpose. This wicked old pagan king could not do anything apart from divine instruction. And I say to you, and here's where I think we can be encouraged in the day in which we live. God's control over heads of state has not stopped. Hasn't stopped. God is in control of Gorbachev today just as much as he was in control of Nebuchadnezzar, just as much as he was in control of Cyrus. But you look, I don't care, you look at him however you want to look at him, and I'm telling you that he's just a pawn in the hand of God. And so is Bush, and so is Reagan, and so is everybody. God's will, you see, is being done. And we ought to rejoice and have confidence in the great sovereignty of our God, who lets nothing and allows nothing to go by chance. It's not that God is just looking at what man wants to do or where man thinks he's going. God is in control. God controlled the liver. See, God controlled that old liver that Nebuchadnezzar used. Can God control the Democratic vote? Sure he can. God controls our vote just as he controls the ancient liver of Nebuchadnezzar. And it's good to know that God is in control and that the forces of this world are just doing what the Lord would have them to do. Now, let me... while I'm in this context, and I most likely will touch on it again under the message of hope, but let's put it in the context here. Verse 25 and following. And thou profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day is come when iniquity shall have an end, thus saith the Lord God, remove the diadem, take off the crown. This shall not be the same. Exalt him that is low and abase him that is high. I will overturn it, and it shall be no more, until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him. All right, now notice what this statement is saying. Judgment is going to come into Jerusalem, and you're going to overthrow it. The city is going to be overthrown, and not only the city, but also the king, the diadem, the crown, is going to be removed. Take away the diadem. Take away the crown. And the crown is going to be removed from Judah, taken away from the house of David, and it's going to stay gone. You remove the diadem, remove it, take it away, and it shall be no more, verse 27. It shall be no more until there's a time when it will be again, but the crown is going to be off until he come whose right it is, and I will give it him. Until he come to whom it belongs, literally. Until he comes to whom it belongs. The crown is going to be taken away, and it's going to stay off anyone in Judah until one comes to whom it really belongs. Now, let me parallel this passage with you to one of the early messianic passages in the book of Genesis. In the patriarchal blessing that we have in chapter 49. And the instructions or the word of blessing that Jacob gives to Judah, beginning in verse 8. Judah, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? Now, this verse particular. The scepter, that is kingship, the sign of kingship, shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh come. And unto him shall the gathering of the people be. So in this early patriarchal blessing upon Judah, there is a promise of kingship that is going to belong to the tribe of Judah. The scepter will not depart from Judah. kingship is promised to Judah. We come finally to the establishment of the Davidic house. And David, of course, a son of Judah, in the tribe of Judah. And there is then the Davidic covenant that's given to David in 2 Samuel chapter 7. The promises there of an eternal kingship, an everlasting, a universal dominion that's going to belong to the ideal son of David. An unconditional promise there because its fulfillment is in the Messiah, is Christ. The ideal son of David promised in that Davidic covenant. Now, I'm pointing this out because there is a very definite connection between what Jacob here says to Judah and what Ezekiel says in chapter 21. The scepter will not depart until Shiloh comes. The word Shiloh, which is here taken as a proper name and becomes a messianic title in the Old Testament, at least understood here. This word, if we were to translate this word, if I were to translate this word Shiloh, it would be this. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver between his feet, until he come to whom it belongs. To whom it belongs. Exactly the same statement that Ezekiel makes back in chapter 21 here, that the crown is going to be off anybody's head until he comes whose right it is. Until Shiloh comes. Until Shiloh comes. Now, it's a different form of the word. I don't want to get into any technical spelling of the words here. Now, but those of you who know Hebrew, if I could just remind you, there are two forms. Don't look at me now. It's not time to sleep. You know Hebrew. Two forms of the relative pronoun, right? You have the asher form, the long form. And then you have an abbreviated form, which is just one letter, an S wedge, the SH that you see there on Shiloh. That's just a relative pronoun. Just a relative pronoun. It can either be a separate word, a share, a separate word, or it can be a single letter that is prefixed to whatever it's being, whatever it's governing. Now, the only difference between Genesis 49:10 and Ezekiel 21 is the form of that particular relative pronoun. In Genesis, it's the simple SH, which is prefixed then to the following form, the following word. Whereas in Ezekiel, it's a separate word. But it's the same exact construction, just a different spelling, alternate spelling of the same idea. You can't miss the connection here, I'm saying. You can't miss the connection. This Shiloh, this one to whom it belongs, from Genesis on, was a messianic hope. From Genesis on, this reference of the kingship not departing until he comes, Shiloh, to whom it belongs, to whom it really belongs, was understood as a messianic hope. And now Ezekiel here in the midst of judgment, and here's one of the interesting developments of Ezekiel's prophecy as he intermingles judgment and restoration, judgment and hope, all in the same context. Here there's judgment coming, yes, and it's total devastation. Kingship is going to be removed. But there's hope because it's going to be given to that one to whom it belongs, to Christ, to the Messiah, to Shiloh. And I say this becomes one of the fascinating messianic passages. In Ezekiel's development, the hope that he gives is a hope that is centered in the person of Messiah himself. But we may have more to say about that when we come specifically to look at the message of hope. Finally, there's two more symbolic acts that we'll mention quickly, and our time will be gone. In chapter 24, verses 15 to 24. We have here a picture of the grief that's going to be so profound during the time of Jerusalem's captivity that external mourning is going to be impossible and inadequate. The grief is going to be so extensive, there's going to be so much death, and there's going to be so much desolation that the people are going to be beyond the ability to grieve, beyond the ability to weep and shed tears because the devastation, the sorrow is so very great. So the Lord gives Ezekiel here a command. His wife dies. His wife dies. And God forbids the prophet to mourn the death of his wife. Don't mourn for her. Don't cry when your wife dies. Show no grief when your wife dies. And this, I say, his command not to grieve over the death of his wife was to be a sign to the people that grief is going to come and desolation is going to come to such a degree that human signs of grief are going to be so inadequate, impossible to even carry through. The devastation, the judgment is going to be that great. So a symbolic act there. Hard on Ezekiel, no doubt. But in obedience to God's word, the failure to grieve for his wife. Then the last symbolic act occurs in chapter 37. Here, finally, we really come to one that expresses his message of hope. This is after the vision of the Valley of the Dry Bones that has been considered more than once from this place. At the end of this chapter, verse 15, following, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah and for the children of Israel, his companions. Take another stick and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel, his companions, and join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand. Take two sticks. On the name of one stick, or on one stick, write the name of Judah. On the other stick, write Joseph or Ephraim, and then bring these two sticks together. That represents one stick. Each represented the divided kingdom. The kingdom that had been divided from the time of Rehoboam and Jeroboam. The north already scattered. But the day is going to come in God's blessing when these two peoples are once again going to be united together. The two sticks of Judah and Ephraim are going to be brought together once again to be a single stick. And the message here is the blessing that the Lord is going to bring upon His people, the restoration of the people. And if you are premillennial in your perspective, the interpretation of that is going to be the reunion of those two kingdoms in that millennial era, which is what the first part of Ezekiel 37 talks about in regard to the Valley of the Dry Bones. But whatever your eschatological perspective there is, you have to see that as a message of hope. A people that have been scattered are going to be reunited. A people that have been divided are going to be brought back together. God's blessing is going to rest upon these people. And the Lord has there still something of a work to do in regard to these people that Ezekiel has pictured as so sinful, a judgment that is pictured as so severe, but there is a message of hope, a message of restoration. So these symbolic acts, part interwoven into the core of Ezekiel's message to give us an overview, really, of where he's going. Much of it is judgment, yes, but there's also that message of hope that involves the Messiah, that involves that final restoration of the people back together. All right, we'll look at some more things, Lord willing, next week. All right, Steve, Dean, would you close us today in word of prayer?